Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, America's persistent historical interference in Nicaragua and its more recent machinations in Ukraine differ only in scale. And though the ruination being made out of the latter is fast becoming total, still the NATO alliance and its international collaborators say push on. Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and likewise for the Green Party of Quebec. Dimitri's interviews for TRNN are at therealnews.com. Dimitri's articles appear at various sites online and at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, where I found his latest piece, Ukraine's Worst Enemies Are Those Who Demand Russia's Strategic Defeat. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Always a pleasure, of course. Now, Dmitry, Vladimir Zelensky addressed the UN General Assembly yesterday, accusing Russia of, quote, weaponizing nuclear power. And this week, he will address Canada's parliament via Zoom and reportedly travel to Toronto, too, presumably in an effort to drum up support for government and elements of the Ukrainian diaspora community. Unlike Zelensky's message of possible victory on the horizon, your article, Dimitri, paints a pretty grim portrait of a stalemated war of attrition resembling nothing so much as World War I. Dimitri, what should Canadians know about the state of the Ukraine war today?
Well, you don't have to take my word for it. You can actually go now. And this is probably the first time since this invasion began, you know, about 18 months ago, where it has been the case, where you could get a semblance of the truth in the mainstream media. And one source that you can go to is the website of the Institute for the Study of War, which is a U.S.-based think tank run by neocons who are, in every conceivable sense of the word, pro-Ukraine, pro-U.S., pro-NATO. And they have a map, which you should take as being a favorable representation relative from to Ukraine's perspective of the facts on the ground. And that map shows what they've accomplished since they launched their counteroffensive on June 4th, 3.5 months ago. The gains are clearly negligible. The amount of territory they've taken, I believe, is somewhere in the range of 40 square miles, which is much less than 1% of the territory that Russia controls. Estimates of the number of casualties they've sustained in this counteroffensive are staggering, ranging from anywhere from 40,000 to 70,000 men. They have expended an enormous amount of ammunition, dozens upon dozens, hundreds actually of armored personnel carriers, other armored vehicles, tanks, including the premier tanks of Britain and Germany, the Leopards and the Challengers, have been destroyed. There's video of that on the battlefield, emerging from the battlefield. So what you have is this was a country that had already taken a tremendous beating in terms of the casualties it had sustained, the destruction of infrastructure, the loss of military materiel. And what you have now is an army that is, I would go so far as to say, on the verge of collapse. Again, you don't need to just rely upon the Institute of the Study of War. You can start looking at, you can find articles in The New York Times, in The Washington Post, in The Guardian even, in the London Times, which say that there have been meager gains, but that the losses have been quite severe. And so I think basically what's happened, Chris, is that reality is catching up with the propaganda. As I mentioned in this most recent article, I predicted, as did many others, in June of last year, that Ukraine was going to lose this war. And the reason for that is very simple. It's because in respect of every category that is relevant for purposes of a large-scale land war, Russia has and has had from the very beginning a very substantial advantage, whether you're looking at population, energy resources, combat aircraft, naval forces, hypersonic missiles, air defense systems, and on and on and on. And it was merely a matter of time before a war of attrition, put Ukraine in a position where it is no longer able to defend itself. And I think it's approaching that rapidly. That's the tragic reality. And the whole point of my article is, you may think you're a friend of Ukraine, but if you're insisting that there be no negotiations to end this war until Russia capitulates, then in fact you are Ukraine's worst enemy, because you are advocating for a course of action that will end in the destruction of this country. And we're perilously close to that point now.
Well, even without the war, Zelensky has been destroying the country, destroying it as a democratic nation, destroying the freedom of the press, destroying the rights of Ukrainian citizens, hauling people off the streets between the ages of, by the looks of it, 16 and 60 to send them raw recruits off to the front. What is the essence of Canada's continued support of Zelensky's endless demand for more weaponry and a continuation of the war?
Well, Canada to date reports, we'll take them at their word, I suppose, the government, that they've contributed in excess of $8 billion in military and economic aid to Ukraine. I have no doubt that they plan to contribute more, not because I have inside sources, but just because the Trudeau government has given absolutely no indication that it's going to shut off the spigot. But I think that the Trudeau government, like all Western governments, are beginning to feel considerable pressure in terms of the amount of money they're expending on this war, and that they are going to diminish. If I had to guess, I would say they're going to diminish the pace at which they contribute to Ukraine in the future. Ukraine is now going to have to adapt in very difficult circumstances to a weaker pipeline of economic and military aid. And I think that whatever it is that they're going to contribute, the Trudeau government, my guess is they've already decided what that number is. And the reason why Zelensky's coming to Canada is not to convince the Trudeau government to contribute more money. It will do that, and it's probably, as I say, decided how much. But he's going to come here to sell it to Canadians and diminish, or at least reduce to the maximum possible degree, the political backlash that the Trudeau government is going to have to confront for this. I think, you know, that's what he's really coming for. This is spectacle. This is theater. There isn't going to be any real debate between Zelensky and Trudeau about whether Canada should continue supporting Ukraine. And at some point, you know, people are going to get fed up. I think we're approaching that point now. And they're going to realize that we're throwing good money after bad. We never should have done this to begin with. And as John Mearsheimer has said, you know, the West has led Ukraine down the primrose path. That's the terrible reality of this situation.
Well, Zelensky was in New York yesterday at the United Nations. It seems some of that enthusiasm is waning fast amongst member nations, too. Some brushing off scheduled meetings with him, some coming out right out. And he made some astonishing declarations, not least of them being charging that Russia is using the nuclear power plants as a nuclear, he's weaponizing these nuclear power plants. He cited Zaporizhia as being used by the Russians as a dirty bomb and accused them of shelling the power plant when in fact the opposite is the case. I mean, has irony completely gone over the heads of the Canadian government?
I don't know why anybody listens to or believes anything that Volodymyr Zelensky has to say anymore, because let's talk about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. There have been inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency crawling all over that plant for months. They have not reported that Russians have shelled the plant. They've never said any such thing. There were claims being made that, you know, by Zelensky months ago that Russia was booby-trapping the plant, getting ready to blow it up. The inspectors from the IAEA said they saw no evidence of that. Zelensky said, you know, on the day on which Antony Blinken, September 6th, came to Ukraine for critical talks on the nature and extent of U.S. support for Ukraine going forward, literally within hours of his arrival, a missile struck a market in an eastern Ukrainian town, killing at least 15 civilians and wounding dozens of others. Immediately, Zelensky came out and said, this is an act of terrorism by Russia. The New York Times just published an article, again, hardly a pro-Russian newspaper, I don't think I need to convince anybody of that, and said that based upon extensive investigation, and they laid out exactly the nature of the investigation that their reporters conducted, it very much appears that was fired by Ukraine from Ukrainian-held territory. They say it was a tragic mistake. If it was a mistake, it clearly was tragic, and it may have been a mistake. But the fact that that missile landed in that market, just as Antony Blinken was arriving in the country for these crucial talks, raises a serious question about whether that, in fact, was a mistake. But one thing is for sure, or reasonably clear, and that is Ukraine fired the missile and it wasn't Russia. And one other example I give, and Chris, I could give dozens of examples where Zelensky has been proven to be wrong and or a liar. He claimed that last year in November, missiles that killed two entered Polish airspace, landed in a field in eastern Poland and killed two Polish farmers, had been fired by Russia, effectively urging NATO to trigger Article 5 and launch World War III. But in fact, within 24 hours, both NATO and the Polish government confirmed that the missiles had been fired by Ukraine. So again, I could go on and on. This man has absolutely no credibility, no matter what the Canadian government says, to gin up the statements and claims of this individual. Nothing that comes out of his mouth should be taken at face value. We should demand independent, credible evidence to back up any claim. And when it comes to, you know, the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia, he has absolutely no independent, credible evidence to back up this explosive and inflammatory claim.
Well, what amazes me, Dmitry, everything you've just said is freely available information on the internet. Is the Ottawa bubble so complete that nothing can penetrate into the consciousness of our representatives and the representatives of the government? Or is this a willful ignorance, do you think, on their part to accept the facts of not only the state of the war today, but also the nature and character of those leading it on the Ukrainian side?
You know, Chris, that's an excellent question. It's one to which I give a lot of thought as somebody who ran, you know, to be the leader of the Green Party of Canada and a party that's represented in Canada's parliament. And the overall impression that I have, to be perfectly blunt about it, is that the last place where the truth arrives in the Western world is Ottawa. Literally the last place. Like, you know, I spend a good bit of time in Greece. I watch also French media, including not just, you know, Quebec language, French language media in Quebec, but media from France itself. And of course, I pay careful attention to the American media. And I'll just give you three examples. I have found since this invasion began, in all three of those media settings, that there is a wider margin for debate. It's still narrow. It's suffocatingly narrow. Anybody who's challenged the narrative has typically been marginalized and demonized. But there's still some margin for debate and questioning. Ottawa, there seems to be absolutely none whatsoever. And the point that you're making is so important. Canadians really need to think carefully about this. Even when the mainstream media in the West is starting to depart in quite dramatic ways from the narrative that's prevailed for the last 18 months, we see no indication whatsoever from the political class. I'm not just talking about the liberals, from the Green Party, from the Conservatives, from the Bloc Québécois, from the NDP. Absolutely no indication that I'm aware of that any single member of any of those caucuses is questioning publicly the Canadian government's policies towards this war. Literally, to this very day, despite the emergence of all of this devastating evidence, you know, with respect to the state of the war, with respect to the dishonesty of Volodymyr Zelensky and the people around him, with respect to corruption in the Ukrainian government, there has not been a peep of dissent from any corner of the mainstream political class in Canada. And that's why I say the last place the truth arrives in the Western world is Ottawa, Ontario. That's the sad reality.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dmitry Lascaris. Dmitry's a Montreal-based activist journalist. He's also an international lawyer. He's served as the justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and for the Green Party of Quebec. His interviews can be found at therealnews.com, and his articles appear at his website. We're talking extensively around his recent piece, Ukraine's Worst Enemies Are Those Who Demand Russia's Strategic Defeat. Well, Canada, of course, as you know, Dmitry, paints itself in very vibrant colors when it comes to democracy, freedom, and high-mindedness. We stand firmly and have signed conventions against the use of cluster munitions, and although not depleted uranium for some bizarre reason, you're going to be appearing today in a webinar, Dmitry, Cluster Bombs and Depleted Uranium Weapons in Ukraine, Two More Reasons to End the War Now. That's being put on by the Peace and Justice Network. You can find them at peaceandjusticenetwork.ca. And Dmitry, you're picking up the cluster bomb side of this argument, and of course, being a lawyer yourself, can you describe what the covenants against their use are, Canada's position on that and why Canada is mum, it seems, on the use and exportation of these weapons by the United States and its allies into this theater of war.
In 2008, a number of states, including Canada, concluded a convention on the use of cluster munitions. There are now 112 state parties, so a majority of the states of this world have become parties to that convention. I would say over three quarters of the members of NATO are parties to that convention. Off the top of my head, the ones who aren't, the NATO members who did not sign on, are the United States, Poland, Romania, Greece, Turkey, Cyprus, and I believe Latvia and Estonia. All the other member states of NATO, including the United Kingdom, Germany, as I mentioned, Canada, France, Spain, Italy, all signed on to this convention. The convention under Article 1 prohibits the use of cluster munitions under any circumstances. But also Article 1, and you see this frequently in treaties of this nature, there's a clause requiring the state parties not to do anything that induces or encourages or facilitates the use of cluster munitions by other states. I think if you look at the conduct of the Canadian government since the United States announced in July that it was going to provide cluster munitions to Ukraine, take into account the fact that it is not, as far as I can tell, objected at all to the provision of these cluster munitions and has continued to supply weapons, although not cluster munitions per se, and economic aid to the government that is currently using those cluster munitions, because they have been using them now for a couple of months on the battlefield. I think you might be able to mount a legal argument that Canada itself is violating Article 1 of the convention, because it is at least implicitly encouraging this behavior. At a bare minimum, it should have objected strongly. You know, when it's providing weapons and economic aid to Ukraine and political support, at a bare minimum, it should have used its influence to strongly object and publicly object to the use of cluster munitions by Ukraine. It hasn't done that. And its policies towards the government haven't altered one iota, not one iota. There's been no penalty imposed by Canada at all. So I think you could mount an argument that Canada is actually in violation of the convention. One thing is for sure. According to the statements of the U.S. government itself, Jen Psaki, the former spokesperson, press secretary of Biden, said in February of last year, because there were reports circulating that Russia was using cluster munitions, although Russia denies that it has done so, she said that this would potentially constitute a war crime. And now that the United States is doing it, that language has disappeared. And the last thing I'll say about this, which is really just probably the most appalling aspect of this entire story, is that the pretext that was offered up for giving Ukraine cluster munitions was that the United States had pretty much run out of the non-prohibited type of artillery, and that these were needed in order to enable Ukraine to succeed in its current counteroffensive. In fact, these weapons were never really designed for the type of warfare that is going on in this counteroffensive. And the proof is in the pudding. The counteroffensive is, as John Mearsheimer, a former U.S. Air Force officer and graduate of West Point, said in a recent analysis, a colossal failure. That's what he said. And so the pretext, which was offered up by the Biden administration for facilitating what Jen Psaki said could constitute war crimes, turns out to have been a pipe dream. It's not just the provision of weapons to Ukraine. We have people on the ground who were trained in Canada's military, who are fighting side by side. They claim to be former soldiers, and maybe they are, but they were trained by the Canadian military, and they're there with the knowledge and tacit approval of the Canadian government. The Canadian government is part of a coalition of states that is providing real-time battlefield intelligence this was reported on by the New York Times, or I think it was the Washington Post a few months ago. They're part of providing real-time battlefield intelligence to the Ukrainians for the purpose of enabling them to kill more Russians. We are effectively a co-belligerent in this war with a country that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt is using cluster munitions. That sounds to me like encouragement, inducement, at least implicitly so. So that, of course, is not an issue which anybody in the mainstream media in Canada has explored with any seriousness, whether Canada itself is in violation of the convention.
Well, yeah, in the United States, their head of the chiefs of staff, the military chiefs of staff, Mark Milley, or Milley, gave a 60 Minutes interview just recently where he admitted as much about the real-time intelligence. And in fact, and all but admitted outright that this is America's war, and the Ukrainian soldiery are just the tools of carrying out its plans.
Right. Yeah, and that's, the fact that they're now talking, and this is a little bit off the subject of cluster munitions, but providing, ATACMS, long-range missiles, and the Germans are saying, if the Americans do that, we'll provide them our own version of these long-range cruise missiles, the Taurus missiles, and already the British have provided the Storm Shadows. So when you have the major NATO powers providing long-range cruise missiles that can strike deep into Russian territory, and at the same time giving the Ukrainians the intelligence to use those missiles accurately, I don't know how you can claim with a straight face that NATO isn't at war with Russia. We are at war with Russia. And it's amazing that we haven't seen to date an escalation to a nuclear attack. I think we're really pushing our luck here, Chris. And people need to come to their senses, give their heads a shake, and bring an end to this thing before it spirals out of control with disastrous consequences for us all.
Well, Sean Penn would call you a coward for talk like that, that only cowards fear nuclear war.
Yeah. Well, I think, Sean Penn's propagandist opinion isn't worth the toilet paper it's written on.
Well, I don't think that we're straying too far from cluster munitions in the sense that they are being used, as you said, because other stuff is running out. And Julian Assange famously talked of Afghanistan, saying that it was less a war than a vast money laundering machine, and that America used for many years, or the military industrial complex there. I wonder, and I asked Ken Stone earlier today the same question, that who's profiting this in Canada, and could it be that the enthusiasm for supporting Ukraine wanes as the money to be made is diminished because they're just simply running out of things to sell them?
Oh, I'm sure that'll have an impact on the elite's enthusiasm for this war. And what's really interesting, I was watching an interview with Ray McGovern yesterday, the former CIA analyst who's become a passionate, eloquent, outspoken critic of the national security state and the neoconservatives in Washington. And he was saying, the reason why the United States has run out of artillery is because they stopped making it on a mass scale. And there were basically two reasons for that. The first is they didn't think that Russia posed any kind of a real threat. So if they had thought that, the Russian Russian army was potentially going to invade a NATO state, they would have maintained high levels of stockpiles of artillery. But the other is that it was not a particularly profitable armament. What the West has done, with the complete connivance of the arms industry, is it has funneled massive amounts of money into the most expensive, overpriced, overrated, high-tech gizmos imaginable. And now we're seeing the impacts of this. The much less expensive, much less sophisticated weaponry that you need to conduct a war of this nature is almost completely gone from the NATO cupboards. And so NATO is in a real world of pain at the moment. And I don't think there's any way out of this short of a much worse escalation than we've seen up until now, either that or negotiations. And hopefully cooler heads prevail and they'll choose the latter option.
Well, it occurs to me that some of our listeners might not know what we're talking about when we mention cluster munitions. And I recall it must have been 30 years or more ago when these were being unveiled. I think it was on 60 Minutes, too, that I was watching an episode where they were showing demonstrations of cluster munitions being used. And I seem to remember that they were designed to blow up airfields because they sent out such a vast amount of shrapnel and everything. They would deploy these things over an enemy airstrip and make it unusable. Could you describe, Dmitry, what these cluster munitions are and why there are these conventions against them?
Well, a cluster munition will contain many bomblets. So it's kind of a casing for a whole bunch of small bombs. And it's designed in such a way that those bomblets are dispersed over a wide area. And so the first problem with cluster munitions is because they're not precise, they don't hit a very narrow defined target, but they're dispersed over a wide area. They end up lying in areas where civilians go. That's the first problem. And the second thing is that every cluster munition, particularly the older ones which are being used, there is a significant failure rate. They're supposed to explode upon impact, but a significant proportion of them, and you know, again, depending upon what proportion depends upon the age and the quality of the munition, will not explode upon impact, and they lie on the ground. And because they don't look like bombs, and because they're small, they look innocuous. Invariably, what happens is civilians and mostly children will step on them or view them as toys and use them. And in fact, the vast majority, there's a monitoring organization, I believe it's called the Cluster Munition Monitor, which I believe is also a creature of the Convention on Cluster Munitions, has been producing annual reports and consistently, you know, reports that upwards of 95% of the victims of these munitions are civilians. And disproportionately of that civilian, you know, population of victims, they're children. So these are truly inhumane weapons, Chris. And they're not designed. This is the thing that's so incomprehensible. They aren't designed for conducting an offensive. You know, you mentioned the case of airfields. My understanding from having listened to military experts, weapons experts, is that the primary use of these cluster munitions was to basically pummel an advancing army. So if somebody is coming at you with a concentration of infantry and you know, armored vehicles spread out over a large area, the cluster munition is designed to deal with that threat. What Ukraine is doing is using them when it is on the offensive and the enemy is hiding in you know, deeply fortified entrenchments. These are not accurate weapons, so they're really not suited to be used for this particular purpose, and they're using them nonetheless. It's absolutely mind-boggling. And, you know, what this demonstrates is both a level of irresponsibility and irrationality that should make all of us very concerned, both on the part of the Biden administration and on the part of its Ukrainian proxy.
Well, and the dud rate, which you mentioned earlier, I've always thought that that was actually a built-in design, that there was a certain percentage of them that were supposed to lie dormant and lie still live, so that they would explode on impact and be used as sort of like a way to lay an instant landmine over a broad or a minefield over a broad area when you have this approaching army of 10 or 12% of those bomblets in their thousands are lying waiting and not exploded, unexploded munitions, then that's a great deterrent to forces that have to traverse that area. But yeah, it's the Landmine and Cluster Munition Monitor that you describe, I believe. It's the -monitor.org with a new report I'm just looking at right now, freshly out on the use and deployment of these munitions.
And I recommend people interested in understanding just how devastating they are and how much harm they've done to civilians around the world. You should visit the website of that excellent organization. But this is really... I can't stress enough that the more these munitions are used in southeastern Ukraine, the more the people of Ukraine themselves will suffer for years to come as a result of that. So again, those who are claiming to be Ukraine's best friends are turning out to be their worst enemies.
And as you outline in your article so eloquently, and again, it's cluster bombs and depleted uranium weapons in Ukraine, two more reasons to end the war now, is the webinar you'll be taking part in, 6 p.m. Eastern today. That's 3 p.m. Pacific, peaceandjusticenetwork.ca. Thanks a lot, Dmitry, for coming on again. And thanks a lot, especially for all of the work that you do. I know you've been super busy these last months with trips to Russia and up into Norway with the Gaza boat and all the other stuff you do. It's inspiring.
Thank you very much, Chris. I much appreciate it.
I also want to thank Jeremy Kuzmarov of the Covert Action Magazine And that's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Thanks again, Dimitri.
Thanks, Chris.